What artist cut off his ear? Rembrandt?
Go on.
What is the water doing when it crests? Making waves?
WHFR, Dearborn.
Are you facing foreclosure? Then come down to Megalow and Partners. We're a mortgage rescue company, and we can help you keep your house. The process is simple. The results are guaranteed 100%. That's the Megalow and Partners promise. Provided you submit to our plans for galactic domination. No, no, I'm kidding. Megalo and Partners, your partner in foreclosure prevention. Stop in anytime.
If you're facing foreclosure, make sure you're talking to the right people. Speak with HUD-approved housing counselors free of charge at 888-995-HOPE. That's 888-995-HOPE. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
Green jobs are here to stay. Why not go green with a degree in alternative energy here at Henry Ford Community College? Students will acquire knowledge in advanced fuel sources and the practice of alternative energy in the world. For more information on the alternative energy program, please contact HFCC's Technology Division by calling 313-317-9816 or by going to hfcc.edu/programs.
Motor Live Drive at 5.
The only local weekly live music show on the radio.
Every Thursday at 5 o'clock for a full hour.
With a full spectrum of local music.
Rock.
Folk.
Jazz.
Blues.
Singer-songwriters.
Rap.
Reggae.
Indie bands.
And rhythm and blues.
If you miss a show, check out the podcast.
There are over 200 musical performances available at the station website, WHFR.FM.
Motor Live Drive at 5, Thursday, 5 till 6 p.m.
On WHFR, we don't just talk about supporting local music, we're doing it.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. Social entrepreneur Billy Parrish joins us today to talk about his company Mosaic, which connects people with high-quality solar projects to invest in. We'll also hear from Josh Buswell-Charco, the executive director of GreenCore, the field school for environmental organizing. And hear from Avital Andrews, the green living editor at Sierra Magazine, about eco-friendly fonts. Billy Parrish is the co-author of Making Good, Finding Meaning, Money, and Community in a Changing World. He's also the founder of the Energy Action Coalition, one of the largest youth advocacy groups working on the climate crisis. He's now a social entrepreneur and has been honored by Rolling Stone as a climate hero. He joins us today to talk about his new project, a company called Mosaic that helps connect people with high-quality solar projects to invest in. Welcome.
Hi.
It's great to have you here. I know we had you on the show a while back when your book came out. It's good to have you in our studio.
Likewise. Thanks.
So we're really excited about Mosaic, this new project, and I'm wondering if you can start by telling us a little bit about how you got the idea to start Mosaic.
So Dan Rosen, one of my co-founders, and I have both done a lot of work in Native American communities trying to figure out how to support them to develop and own their own renewable energy resources. As we started doing that work, we applied to a business incubator called the Unreasonable Institute in Colorado.
Great name.
Yeah. And while we were there, we actually realized that at the core of that idea was an even simpler idea, that all of us should be able to own and develop our own renewable energy resources. All of us should be able to be part of the transition to clean energy. So we built Mosaic as a platform to enable people to invest in financing the clean energy infrastructure we need to get to 100% clean power.
Now, how does Mosaic work? What does that mean that people can invest in these projects?
So we go out and we find the best projects that need financing.
And in many cases, my understanding is these are not the big, huge kind of solar factories, right? These are small local projects that communities wish they could fund but don't have the money to fund.
Yeah. So we're right now focused on community scale solar projects. And there's just not enough financing out there from the banks to do those projects. So a lot of those projects are languishing. You know, these are great investment grade projects that we're enabling people to collectively invest in.
So in other words, if a school wants to put solar panels on the roof, or if a low-income housing project wants to put solar panels on their roof, right now, without Mosaic, how would they do that? They would try to go to the bank and get a loan, and they might be approved or not. I mean, how does that work, and what problem is Mosaic solving?
So we are substituting people for the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Up until this point, energy investing has been a bank-only thing, and there are only a few players in the space, so the cost of the financing that they provide is too high, and there's just not enough of it. The banks are interested in doing utility-scale projects and big tranches of cookie-cutter residential projects, but that sort of commercial segment of the market is not being filled by the banks right now. So Mosaic's really filling that need while providing an amazing investment product for the general public.
Well, let's talk about that investment side of things, because it's clear how it benefits the community that wants to put solar panels on their community center. They get a loan with, I'm assuming, lower interest rates than what a bank might provide. But how do the folks who are investing actually benefit?
Our first projects have ranged between 4.5% annual rate of return and 6.38% annual rate of return. So Mosaic passes on most of the interest that we collect for financing these projects to our investors. So we just take 1% of off the top, and the rest goes towards paying back the investors.
So the investors are making a profit by helping to create the green energy revolution.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that you're a little different from other companies in the sense that almost anyone can be an investor, at least in certain states. You don't have to be rich to qualify to invest in these projects.
Yeah. So that's been our mission since the beginning, is to open up this asset class to everyone. Right now, residents of California and New York can invest for as little as $25 in a solar project. We also have investments still available for accredited investors in all 50 states, people who have over $1 million of net worth or make over $200,000 a year in income. So, you know, that's a lot of people across the country. And really, for the first time, we're making it very, very easy for people to invest in clean energy.
So do you have middle-class families, I mean, not accredited investors, people like a, you know, school teacher in LA or a grandma in Fresno who are actually putting money down into these projects?
Yeah, so we just launched on January 7th for these first return on investment projects. And in that one day, over 400 people became clean energy investors, people from all walks of life. We sold out all of the publicly available projects we had in less than 24 hours. So, you know, it was just amazing to see how the public reacted. For the first time they could invest, there was all this pent-up demand, and they fully funded all those projects. So we have one project still available to accredited investors, but the ones that are open to everyone in California and New York are all sold out. So we're working to get more up on the platform now, but it was just amazing to see that demand is there, that people want to invest in tangible assets that they can understand instead of, you know, Wall Street or putting their money in a bank and who knows what it's doing.
Well, also, it's just such a feel-good thing to think that even if you don't have a lot of money, you don't have a lot of savings, you can still chip in $50 and, you know, be an investor in a really great solar project at a maybe even a local community center that you know.
Yeah. The green space has had this baggage around, you know, you need to take lower returns or, you know, you need to do less of things. And for us, it's exciting to kind of reposition green as it can be good for your wallet, good for your community, good for climate. We actually can have all of those things. And And that's what we're trying to do with Mosaic.
What I think is really interesting is that a lot of people think of this space or have traditionally thought of this space more as charity, something they have to make a donation to do. If they want, you know, if they want to create the solar revolution, they should write a check to a small nonprofit that's working to do this locally. What's cool about this is that it's not actually a donation. You get your money back. You put the money in, you help with the solar revolution, and you actually make a return on it, right?
Yeah. And right now, we just have these debt investments that people can participate in. But we're developing IRA products so people can retire on the sun. People can really grow their money. And, you know, I have two little kids, and I want to create an educational savings account for them. And I don't want to put that into investments that are going to kill their future. I want to put the money that I need to save for them for college into something that's going to be good for their future. And so we're creating other kinds of investment products that allow people to grow their money with the sun.
And is it the same idea that all these investment products would be available to people who are just middle-class families?
Absolutely. We're democratizing energy and finance, which are the two biggest industries in the world and two of the most broken industries in the world. And we think people participating in them is going to be really important to solving and fixing those industries.
Now, I noticed back in the day when I first heard about your company, you were Solar Mosaic, and now you're just Mosaic. Is that because you're thinking of expanding to other things beyond solar?
Yes. Our vision is abundant clean energy for and by the people. And that involves electric vehicle infrastructure, battery storage, energy efficiency, wind. You know, it's going to take a lot of different things to get us to 100% clean energy. We're very excited about solar. That's where we're starting. But, you know, we want to finance all kinds of things and allow people to participate.
Tell us a little bit more about your personal journey. You know, you started as an activist. I know there's this legendary story about how you dropped out of Yale on a dream to pursue founding a climate movement for youth, and you ended up indeed doing that and starting the Energy Action Coalition, which has been hugely successful. What is your personal transition like to go from that sort of more confrontational activism to this different way of providing people tools, let's say, in the financial realm?
So, you know, there was a moment for me after we lost the battle in Copenhagen after we failed to pass federal climate legislation in the U.S., that I just felt that we needed to try something new. We needed to deepen and broaden our constituency. We needed to accelerate the solution side of the equation. And I kind of fell in love with solar and clean technologies. And as I looked at the math on climate, that was the X factor that felt to me like it could really avoid the worst consequences of climate change. If we can rapidly accelerate the transition to clean energy, I think that's our best hope for avoiding, you know, the terrible things that I've been worrying about for my whole career. And to have a value proposition where people can make money solving the climate, leveraging the capital markets, leveraging the incredible power of capitalism, it just feels amazing. I'm so happy to be on the business side. And, you know, I'm going to be in D.C. for the Keystone XL protests. But I'm excited to be building on the solution side and working with all my friends, you know, at the Sierra Club and in other movement organizations that are, you know, on the nonprofit side as well.
Now, what do you say when people tell you that sort of right-wing talking point about how solar can never get to scale? Solar can never replace dirty energy because we only get a small percentage of our power from solar, and even if we doubled it, it would still be small. How do you respond to that?
Happily, there is now an existence proof that that's false. You look at Germany, you know, last summer they got over half of their power from the sun, you know, throughout parts of the year, and 17 times more solar was installed in the last decade than the analysts projected.
Mm-hmm.
The International Energy Agency is now ramping up their predictions of how much solar there will be in our electricity mix by 2050. We will be mainly a solar-powered world.
Hmm.
You know, it really is only a small set of folks, many of whom are funded by the fossil fuel industry, who are denying that clean energy can meet most, if not all, of our energy needs in the long term.
Okay, so for our listeners who are interested now and want to find out more about Mosaic or possibly even invest, what do you recommend? What are the next steps?
Joinmosaic.com is our website. It's very simple, takes a couple minutes to set up an account. We will have our next round of investments for everyone in California and New York in a couple weeks. And we already have investments for accredited investors in all 50 states.
Now, just tell us really quickly, why is it for non-accredited investors, average folks in California and New York, but then in the other states that's not available yet? Do you hope to bring it there soon?
One of the hardest nuts we had to crack in building this business was getting approval from state security regulators to offer our investments to the public. We've now done that in California and New York and are working to expand into other states.
And that's because they usually try to protect middle-class families who might be hit too hard by a loss in the investment. Is that right? So they only let people invest who have enough net worth that it wouldn't devastate their finances?
Right.
So it must be a sign of confidence that in California and New York, they're saying that solar, this is a good enough investment that they're willing to let middle-class families actually go into it because they don't perceive it as being that risky.
Yeah. And, you know, it is an investment. There are risks involved. We are very transparent about those risks. Mm-hmm. People can download the prospectus for each of our projects on the platform. They're all there.
To wrap up here, I'm curious to hear from you. What are you most optimistic about when it comes to the clean energy future?
We actually built Mosaic for the next generation of clean energy technologies. I'm seeing solar and wind and battery and motor technologies on the horizon that will be an order of magnitude better than what is currently on the market. And when we get to that point where the new clean energy technologies will be so much more cost effective than the fossil fuel technologies that dominate our energy mix now, that they will replace them faster than we ever thought was possible.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Billy Parrish. He's the founder of a company called Mosaic that helps connect people with high quality solar projects to invest in. For more information, you can visit them at joinmosaic.com. Joining us now in our studio is Josh Buswell Charco. He's the executive director for Green Corps, the Field School for Environmental Organizing. Welcome.
Thanks, Orly.
So Green Corps recently had its 20th anniversary. I'm curious if you can tell our listeners a little bit more about what that means, the founding of Green Corps and the organization's mission. What do you guys do?
Absolutely. So the mission of Green Corps is to train organizers, provide field support for today's critical environmental campaigns, and graduate activists with the skills, temperament, and commitment to fight and win tomorrow's environmental battles. And we got our start out of Earth Day 1990. So this was the largest Earth Day in history. Over 200 million people took part. And there was just a surge of interest in the environment coming out of that. So you might remember there was this book that came out, 50 Easy Things You Can Do to Save the Planet.
I think I owned that book.
And, recycling became really popular, so curbside recycling. And academia followed suit. So we saw a surge in the creation of environmental studies departments. And so as kind of a consequence of that, there were all of these students that were graduating from college. They had majored in environmental studies. They were really interested in environmental issues, and they wanted to put their values to work when they graduated, but there weren't many places for them to go, right? So most of the environmental organizations out there were looking for people who had experience, and so the options for them were either to go and intern or to go to law school. Simultaneously, while that's going on, a lot of groups in the environmental movement were more focused on kind of inside the beltway activities, right? So more kind of lobbying in DC. And they weren't really capitalizing on this interest in communities all across the country in the environment. So USPIRG in 1992 started Green Corps. USPIRG had been training people in the skills of organizing, but they weren't focused specifically on the environment. So they created Green Corps to be a field school, almost like a graduate school, to teach people how to do environmental organizing through a combination of learning in a classroom type setting, bringing in issue experts, and then actually deploying these people to go and work on urgent environmental campaigns in communities across the country.
I think for our listeners, sometimes people aren't really clear on what is meant by organizing. So when you talk about environmental organizing, what do you really mean?
Absolutely. Organizing is the process of activating and engaging citizens to wield their collective power to enact change.
So kind of what people think about when they think about campaigning, but on the local level.
I think it kind of flows from the premise of we're stronger united than we are divided. And so we choose environmental organizing for a couple of reasons. One, we think that the big environmental problems that we face are political problems at their core. Basically, our decision makers lack the political will to do the right thing for our environment. So if you believe that, then the second thing is that while we certainly need more environmental lawyers and we need more environmental educators, we need a lot more environmental organizers to go out there and mobilize the people power to hold our decision makers accountable for their decisions on the environment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you look at the myriad of environmental issues that are out there, right, you know, global warming, chemicals in our food, mountaintop removal. There are solutions out there to these problems, right? Ralph Nader has this terrific quote where he says, America has more problems than it deserves and more solutions than it applies. You know, these solutions, they're right there. They're at our fingertips. And a lot of times they're just not being implemented because our decision makers are being unduly influenced, frankly, by, you know, big corporations and polluting industries. So while we certainly think that we need to get out there and educate people about, you know, environmental problems, and we certainly need to be, you know, suing these companies when they're breaking the law, we also think that our greatest strength is people. So we need to be going out there and organizing people to hold our decision makers accountable if we're going to see the kinds of changes that we need for a better planet.
Right. I mean, I think that it's just clear that even though litigation plays an important role, we're not going to be able to sue our way out of this problem.
Right. And we also kind of think that, you know, the law is certainly important, but it doesn't capitalize on our biggest asset, which is people. Right? People want a clean environment. They want healthy air. They want clean water to drink. And so organizing allows us to take advantage of that asset.
So Green Corps was founded to give these young, passionate college students a way to enter that career and also to become organizers. What has that meant over the past 20 years? What kinds of people have you trained? I mean, you know, who's come out of the program? What kind of an impact is it making?
Yeah.
Because I know, I mean, one of the interesting things about Green Corps is that it's pretty small organization. I mean, you're only training, I think, anywhere between 15 and 35 people a year, but those people have gone on to have a really surprising amount of influence in the environmental world.
We're, you know, tremendously proud of all of our alumni. So we've graduated over 300 people now in the past 20 years, and we're pleased to say that, you know, 80% of them are staying engaged in kind of the broader social change movement. So, you know, we've got graduates, folks like Sarah Hodgson, who works here at the Sierra Club as the conservation director, is a Green Corps alum. Phil Radford, who's the executive director of Greenpeace USA, was in the Green Corps class of 1999. Justin Rubin, who was the former executive director of MoveOn.org, is a Green Corps alum. Heather Smith, who's the president of Rock the Vote, is a Green Corps alum. So national organizations, but then also a lot of regional organizations. So Aaron Viles, who's the deputy director for the Gulf Restoration Network, a group that's doing terrific work on the BP oil disaster, is a Green Corps alum. Greg Small, who runs Climate Solutions, which is doing a lot of work around promoting clean energy and clean energy jobs in the Pacific Northwest, is a Green Corps alum. So it's really neat to look across the broader environmental and social change movement and see all of these people who learn these valuable skills during their Green Corps year and are now putting them to good use for a better planet.
What does the training look like? How do you give people skills to be able to run campaigns against huge, massive, wealthy corporations? Is that something you can teach? Is it just about tenacity and ingenuity? Mm-hmm. You know, how much of it is instinct and how much of it is skill?
Yeah. I mean, there are a whole set of skills that you can teach people. You know, when I was in college and I was involved in activism, I always wished that I'd actually learned some of these skills and I was working on campaigns. But the way that the program works is it's divided into three components. So the first part is the classroom training component. So all of our organizers receive about 7 weeks of training in a classroom type setting spread out over the course of the year. And they're learning everything from, you know, basic recruitment 101, how you actually go out and find someone and recruit them to get involved in your campaign, and then how you develop them as leaders, how to build a coalition, how to talk to the media, how to develop a campaign plan. So really the nuts and bolts not only of running a campaign, but I think the foundation for running an organization in a lot of ways. And one thing that I think is particularly neat about our classroom training component is we bring in lots of issue experts and people that have been in the field for a really long time. So, you know, you might get a lecture from Bill McKibben, who's, you know, a noted author and environmental activist, or, you know, Margie Ault, who's the executive director of Environment America, might come in and do a training for you. But we definitely believe in learning by doing. So the bulk of the year is actually spent in the field running urgent environmental campaigns. And so, you know, in the past couple of years, we've actually done a lot of work with the Sierra Club working on the Beyond Coal campaign. So embedding organizers in communities across the country to retire some of the nation's oldest and dirtiest coal-fired power plants. We've done a lot of work with an organization called Food and Water Watch, working to promote more environmentally friendly farm practices in the next farm bill. So it's neat because, you know, you might be fresh out of college, but you're working on these really important, very profound issues at a really young age. The final part of the year is job placement. So when the year comes to a conclusion, we work with all of our organizers to help them to find a career in the broader social change movement. So we have more than 300 alumni that have gone through our program. We've partnered with dozens of organizations over the year. And our organizers have a reputation for being, you know, hardworking, goal-oriented, very strategic thinkers. And so as the year comes to a conclusion, we help all of our organizers to kind of launch their career in the broader social change movement.
And how do you recruit people? How can interested candidates apply for the program?
The process is pretty easy. So basically, so long as you've got a college diploma and you care about the environment, you can apply to Green Corps. And
can you apply before you get the diploma, like if you're still in your senior year?
You can absolutely. Thank you. Yes, you can certainly apply. And in fact, you should apply if you're a senior, but you could certainly apply after you've graduated too. And the easiest way to do that is actually just to go to greencorps.org, and all of the directions are right there.
Thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Josh Buswell Charco. He's the executive director of Green Corps, the field school for environmental organizing. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Andrews, the Green Living editor at CR Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Marley.
So today we're going to talk about something a little more unusual. I know we usually talk with you about things like eco-friendly tips for certain holidays or which kind of ice cream is the greenest and that type of thing. But we're going to talk about something you did recently for CR Magazine that's actually about fonts.
Right.
What does that mean to be a green font, like a computer font? I mean, how did you even come to that topic?
Yeah, well, I came to that topic because I found out about a typeface that a man named Steve Madison had designed, and it was inspired by Half Dome in Yosemite. So I just got really intrigued, and I wanted to interview him about this process of designing a font based on something in Yosemite. So I called him up and just had a conversation and sort of wrote my piece about the process of him designing this font. So this particular font isn't necessarily eco-friendly, although there are others. We can get that to that in a second, but it's basically a tribute to Yosemite. He's a really big typeface designer. He created the default fonts on the Android and Windows smartphones. And if you play Xbox, which I don't, but I know a lot of people do, he created all the letters that you see when you play video games on the Xbox. He's both an artist and a technician, and he's never really designed a font just for making himself happy. And so he just went out into Yosemite and looked to the mountains for inspiration, and just did a bunch of pencil sketches. And in the magazine, you can see the sketches that he actually did and how the letters look. But the letters themselves are hollowed out, like the O, the hollow out in the O is actually the exact contour of Half Dome.
Hmm.
It's a little hard to explain without having the visual, so you really need to go to crmagazine.com to read the piece. But it's great. And he envisions these letters being used for anything kind of eco-friendly or organic. He pictures them on, say, like an organic, eco-friendly coffee brand or something that really just needs to convey a sense of earthiness.
Well, I mean, when you do look at the letters, I mean, they look earthy. It's interesting how different fonts can evoke different emotions. But,
you know,
I wouldn't have guessed Yosemite instantly, but when I know the backstory, when you see the font, it does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly. He had a great quote. He says it's a hidden homage to Half Dome, and he says that computers are really good at making straight lines and perfect circles, but to give the letters a more natural look, he drew them freehand with a pencil and just it made sure to include the unique contrast, which he describes as the glacial polishing with jaggedness and gradual smooth curves that all of a sudden sharpen off into an abrupt straight line. And those are the elements that he put into it. It's kind of, like I said, it's an art and a craft at the same time. And it's something that you can actually get on your computer. It's at fonts.com, and you can get it for starting at $54 and then going way up for a lot of more professional uses. But
and what is the font called?
It's called Massif Pro.
Massif Pro. Interesting.
Yes.
Now, I was curious about something else that you said. You said there's also such a thing as eco-friendly fonts. How is that possible? What does that even mean?
Yeah, there's one in particular that's just called EcoFont, and it purports to save ink. And if you can imagine it, it has a bunch of little holes in the letters, kind of like Swiss cheese, but the holes are so small that you can't even see them when you print them out. So basically, you're printing out a document, it looks the same, you know, it looks like maybe Arial or something, but it's a lot less ink that's being used to
and so fewer print. Ink cartridges to throw away.
Exactly. Exactly. And less resources needed to produce the ink itself. But, you know, that's all with a caveat is that it's better not to print at all. If you're going to print, it's better to use an eco font that saves ink.
You just get it at...
You can get it at a website called Dutch. It's DUTCH.CO. Not com.
Have to look into that. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Avital Andrews. She's the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
WHFR and Metaphysically Speaking are teaming up once again in order to bring you our 5th annual Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair on Saturday, March 23rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Henry Ford Community College Student and Culinary Arts Center. As usual, we are thrilled and excited to bring you this premier holistic event. This year's festival promises to be bigger and better than ever. If you would like to join us as a vendor, reader, or body healer, please call 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. Once again, that's call us at 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. We hope you are able to join us at this fantastic festival.
Are you facing foreclosure? Then come down to Megalow and Partners. We're a mortgage rescue company, and we can help you keep your house. The process is simple. The results are guaranteed 100%. That's the Megalow and Partners promise. Provided you submit to our plans for galactic domination. No, no, I'm kidding. Megalow and Partners, your partner in foreclosure prevention. Stop in anytime.
If you're facing foreclosure, make sure you're talking to the right people. Speak with HUD-approved housing counselors free of charge at 888-995-HOPE. That's 888-995-HOPE. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
Welcome to WHFR. I am the Diva, and I would love for you to allow me to add a little heat to your Monday nights. Please join me for Lyrical Infusion every Monday evening from 7 to 9 p.m., where I blend the lyrics with the melodies to create magical moments of music. Just for you. Lyrical Infusion with the Diva, Mondays from 7 to 9 p.m. WHFR 89.3. Streaming live at WHFR.FM 24/7.
HFCC's associate degree program in automotive technology includes detailed instruction related to the various systems found on today's vehicles. This program is designed to provide students with a thorough knowledge of the technical aspects of the automobile and to develop a certain level of manual skill in servicing, testing, and diagnosing. Classroom and laboratory classes provide students with the experience and understanding they'll need to qualify in numerous fields of employment associated with the automobile industry. For more information on HFCC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology, contact Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350. That's Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford Community College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Metro Detroit is going down every single Monday night, 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. That's the Zone right. Radio with Richardson, D.C., only here at 89.3. The station right making waves across the Great Lakes, WHFR.FM. That's right, Detroit. Detroit's longest running hip hop show. The Zone Radio with Riggs in DC.
Disclaimer. This show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
It's the world's biggest telescope, yet it doesn't use light. This week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. It will make sharper images than the Hubble Space Telescope, yet it is a radio telescope. ALMA is the gigantic instrument already in operation, 5,000 meters or about 3 miles above sea level in Chile's Atacama Desert. We'll talk to two of the scientists who are part of the International ALMA team, along with all of our regulars, beginning with Emily Lakdawalla. Emily, thanks for joining us, as always. I want to look back to something you posted on the 16th of January, actually the 15th and the 16th. It's an indication, I guess, that scientists did the right thing taking this little detour with Curiosity on Mars.
That's right, Matt. You know, the rover operators faced a really tough decision months ago when they first decided where to start driving. The thing is that they knew that they were going to have to test out all the equipment on some Martian rocks, and they really want to drive to the mountain that's in the middle of the crater. But there were some interesting looking rocks that were not very far from the rover, but precisely in the wrong direction. Hmm. Well, they decided to go to those interesting looking rocks that were closer, and that's where they've been doing all their tests. And lo and behold, it is a kind of rock that is exactly what Curiosity was sent to Mars to study. We're looking at lake bed sediments that have been wet over at least two, probably three different times in Mars's history. So it's preserving a record of water on Mars at least two, maybe three different episodes. It's precisely what Curiosity went to Mars to do. And so they are so excited that they went on this detour to study these rocks.
Great results already, obviously. And kind of complementing that, another terrific picture from HiRISE.
Yeah, and this one was almost, and it wasn't precisely accidental that they got the rover, but they were specifically shooting some color imaging of Curiosity's future trek. But of course, the swath of the image caught Curiosity parked at Glen Elg, exploring some of those really exciting rocks. And it's just, it's fresh and amazing every single time I see a picture of human-built hardware on the surface of another planet.
So it's in the blog on the 15th and 16th, those entries that Emily made. Be sure to look at the close-up of a rover on Mars and then the panorama it took from exactly that picture. With a few seconds left, do you want to congratulate the Chinese?
Absolutely. You know, they took a spacecraft that they built for lunar exploration, and they, you know, had a spacecraft had a little lifetime left. They're like, hey, let's fly it past an asteroid, which is really not something that one can imagine you can ordinarily do with a spacecraft past its lifetime. And they did, and they got tons of images of this weird-shaped asteroid. I don't think it's a potato or a yam. I've decided it's a space ginger root.
Which somehow seems appropriate.
Yeah, it is a Chinese mission after all.
Well, definitely congratulations to everyone behind the Chang'e 2 mission. And Emily, thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you, Matt.
She is a senior editor for the Planetary Society and our planetary evangelist, a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Up next is Bill Nye, but Bill joins us from a hotel in Washington, where, as you'll hear, he was there for the inauguration. But he also took some time to talk to Casey Dreyer, one of our colleagues at the Society.
Thank you, Matt. I am here with our outreach and advocacy strategist, Casey Dreyer.
Yeah, I was in Washington, D.C. all last week, visiting people on the Hill, visiting people at NASA headquarters, and kind of meeting and strategizing with other people in the space policy area.
So, Casey, you met with Dianne Feinstein or her people?
Yes, I met with the staffer in charge of the space policy for Dianne Feinstein and talked to him about the importance of not just the Mars program at JPL, but also the outer planets and missions like Europa or missions to Europa that we really want to see happen in this next decade.
Are they supportive? Are they in?
They are interested. Again, most people are never against planetary science. The real question, as most things come down to in Washington these days, is how are you going to pay for it? And it's really something that Congress can do. But again, the advantage that we have here for planetary science and at the Planetary Society is that the money required to do these missions is just not very much. We're talking about less than 2% of NASA's budget to be moved back to planetary science. So they can find ways to do that.
2% of NASA's budget, which is 0.4% of the federal budget.
Yes. So we're talking about vanishingly small numbers that are losing all meaning, really, when you're talking about it in that larger context. So,
but the vanishingly small number you're talking about is $302 million this year, right? And about $300 million in coming years. Is that right?
Yeah. If we keep it flat at $1.5 billion, that's returning about $300 million. And keeping it like that for the next 5 years, we can do missions like a mission to Europa. We can do the Mars sample return mission. And then we can do a bunch of other really exciting small missions to other parts of the solar system. Again, it's a lot of money to an individual, but we're not talking about individuals here. We're talking about the federal government, and it can very much work.
So who else did you speak with?
I met a staffer at Judy Chu's office. Judy Chu is the congressional representative here around Pasadena. She just got redistricted into this area and has taken a much larger interest in space policy. She's been saying some very exciting, very supporting things about JPL's Mars program. And again, I met with her staffer to share that it's not just Mars. There are missions to Europa and these smaller missions called Discovery missions that are really important too, and that all of those would benefit the community here.
And, of course, they would help humankind make discoveries that could change the world. No big deal.
Toss that in at the end.
Just great job, man. I'm Bill Nye, CEO of the Planetary Society, handing it back to Matt Kaplan.
Travel south to Chile's Atacama Desert, where so many of our planet's most powerful telescopes can be found, and you'll also find a growing array of gigantic radio dishes arrayed across a plain that is 5,000 meters above sea level. This is ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. With a year to go before it is completed, ALMA is already enabling astronomers to make discoveries no other telescope has been capable of. The project is a partnership that includes the European Southern Observatory, Canada, Japan, Taiwan, Chile, and the United States. Al Wotan has been working on this project for 30 years. He is the North American Project Scientist and head of the North American ALMA Science Center at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Allison Peck has just returned from 5 years of shuttling between Santiago and the telescope site, where she led a team of ALMA commissioning scientists. Here are excerpts of our conversation at the recent meeting of the American Astronomical Society. The complete interview, which is more than twice as long, can be heard online at planetary.org/radio. We just came a few moments ago out of a session that you chaired, Al, with the scientists working with this instrument. While I did not, I have to admit, understand a lot of their data, I sure noticed that they kept using these adjectives like remarkable, amazing, fantastic, and this about an instrument that's only partially complete.
Absolutely. Just 16, 17, 18 of the eventual 66 antennas were involved in the data that we saw.
What is it that ALMA is going to be able to do for the astronomy community that no other instrument has ever been able to do?
Well, we'll be able to peer into the cool universe, the cold, dusty places where stars are being formed and planets are being formed, with a sharpness of vision that nobody's been able to use before. And that will enable us to discover how and where stars are formed, how and where planets are formed, much like the planets in the solar system. But additionally, because distant galaxies are at large redshifts, their whole spectrum gets shifted from the optical part of the spectrum into the millimeter part of the spectrum. And so an additional aspect of ALMA is that the galaxies, which are faint optically because their emission has been redshifted out of that portion of the spectrum, are bright for ALMA. And so we have an unusual advantage in being able to see very distant galaxies pretty sharply, as you saw in many of the talks this morning.
I read about five different areas of research that ALMA will be able to conduct.
really these capabilities, while it's not limited to looking back toward the beginning of the universe, that's one of the things, obviously, that ALMA's going to do better than any other instrument.
That's right. That's right. And in particular, at the wavelength ranges that we're looking at, the sensitivity that we have is unprecedented. There have been submillimeter interferometers before, and they're still going, and they're very good instruments. But with limited sensitivity, they have fewer antennas, they have smaller antennas. And so with the advent of ALMA, we're able to observe a large number of sources in a very small amount of time. And that means that we can do more complete surveys. We can build up statistics about the galaxies in the early universe. If you look at one object, you may be able to learn quite a bit about that object, but you don't learn a lot about the topic of galaxy evolution. You need to look at a large number of galaxies in order to see what the general trends are, what the majority of galaxies were doing. And that's one of the doors that ALMA opens. We can look very far back towards the beginning of the universe, and we can look at a very large number of galaxies and find out what the trends are, how they tended to evolve, when the stars are formed, whether they have active galactic nuclei inside, that sort of thing.
So very much like, I mean, exactly like optical astronomy, that superb sensitivity that you'll have means not only can you look at fainter objects, but you can look at more of them because your observation time doesn't have to be as long.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
To my surprise, ALMA, which is going to be looking back to the beginning of everything, it may also be able to help out with things much closer to home, right here in our own solar system.
Yeah, when you look at an asteroid or some of the deep solar system Kuiper Belt objects, for instance, you're looking at reflected sunlight, and so it's very difficult to tell how large the object is. What you're really looking at is how good a mirror it is for reflecting the sunlight back. And so you don't get a very good estimate of its size. But ALMA directly images the thermal radiation, the mass of rock at a certain temperature emits at the ALMA wavelengths. And so by measuring the emission from these objects at ALMA wavelengths, you can actually get an estimate of the mass much better than you can optically. And so ALMA will be very important for doing that, particularly as we begin to explore the distant solar system with the New Horizons mission coming up, getting close to Pluto, which we now realize has, I've lost track, four
moons. It's quite a busy
quite
place.
A few moons, right? And you don't want one of them to hit the spacecraft when it goes past. So we need to know the orbits of those very accurately. From the Earth, we have the moon to worry about optically. That doesn't affect radio observations at all. And so we can look at the very faintest objects basically anytime.
One of the other exciting things that we can do with ALMA is because we can detect molecules and using the Doppler shift, the Doppler effect, we can see what direction they're moving. We can see whether they're moving towards us or away from us. And we have high enough resolution to be able to see what the distribution of molecules is in the atmospheres of planets in our solar system. And so that means that we can measure how fast the winds are blowing in different parts of the atmosphere on planets in our system. Saturn, for example, was one of the Cycle Zero projects. And so we can actually see what the weather is like on other planets. And that gives us a very good sense of what the conditions would be like if you were on the surface that we can see from Earth.
Mar from Al Watson and Allison Peck about ALMA is moments away. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, hey, Bill Nye here, CEO of the Planetary Society, speaking to you from PlanetFest 2012, the celebration of the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity landing on the surface of Mars. This is taking us our next steps in following the water in the search for life to understand those two deep questions. Where did we come from, and are we alone? This is the most exciting thing that people do, and together we can advocate for planetary science and, dare I say it, change the world.
Hi, this is Emily Lakdawala of the Planetary Society. We've spent the last year creating an informative, exciting, and beautiful new website. Your Place in Space is now open for business. You'll find a whole new look with lots of images, great stories, my popular blog, and new blogs from my colleagues and expert guests. And as the world becomes more social, we are too, giving you the opportunity to join in through Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and much more. It's all at planetary.org. I hope you'll check it out.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. We're talking with Al Watson and Allison Peck, two leaders of the International Radio Telescope project known as ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, now nearing completion in Chile's Atacama Desert.
ALMA uses interferometry to make its many individual instruments act as a single gigantic telescope. How is it that you're going to be able to get 66 dishes spread across this plane to function like one gigantic telescope?
Well, not easily, but so far all the telescopes are sort of within a kilometer of the home base. We're just constructing the more distant pads and putting the wiring in to connect them up. So that's one of the big jobs that we have over the next year as we finish up with the construction. Eventually, it covers 16 kilometers. It's about the size of the Washington Beltway that we have covered with antennas. And that will enable us to give an acuity of vision, sort of like the Hubble Space Telescope, well, better than the Hubble Space Telescope has. So we'll get very fine details in all these objects.
So there were a number of challenges associated with that, and not least of which is that we have antennas coming from the different regions of the project. So they were built by different companies, and all of the antennas have to meet very, very specific parameters so that they all operate in exactly the same manner, and they all have to respond exactly the same way to the software. So obviously, we have a very large software package operating the telescope because it has to move all of the antennas in unison. They have to be moving at exactly the same rate and pointing at exactly
incredible
the same
precision.
Place. Incredible precision, that's right. And all of the signals have to come underground on optical fibers to a supercomputer called the correlator. Now, the correlator multiplies these signals together to construct one single image from all of these diverse antennas. And so the software challenge there is enormous. And we've had very good people working on it for a number of years. And so now we are able, in fact, to move the antennas to kilometers apart, be able to look at exactly the same point in the sky, and add the signals together to make the fantastic images, some of which you saw downstairs in the special session.
Talk a little bit more about this correlator, because I have read that this is one of the most powerful supercomputers on this planet now, and certainly the one that is higher in altitude than any other.
Right. So one of the challenges you face is is cooling it. That's a lot of electronics. If you were to look at a picture of the building at the high site, a lot of it is involved just with the cooling machinery to keep the correlator cool. Furthermore, there's no air up there, and a lot of the data and your devices that you have in your pocket and in front of you are written on hard disks with magnetic technology. But we have to use diskless technology up there because the air pressure is such that it won't support the flying heads that ride on the disks.
Gosh.
Yeah, so there are a lot of challenges with moving that much data.
I've got to throw one number at you because it looked like a typo. 137 million processors in the system?
Yeah, it's an impressive supercomputer, but you have to remember that it's designed for a single purpose. Mm-hmm. And so it's not as versatile as a lot of the computers that are called supercomputers. But because it has a very specific design for a specific function, then all of the effort can go into making it as fast as possible and also as robust as possible, because you don't want to have to service it very often at 5,000 meters. It is one of the highest supercomputers in the world, as you mentioned.
One interesting aspect of it is we're high up, and so the cosmic ray flux is pretty high. And the cosmic rays can damage some of the electronics.
Just so as they do with spacecraft now.
Right, and so it has self-check circuits in it, which actually check for cosmic ray damage.
This brings up an interesting point, which I knew was true in the general public, but I didn't realize was so true among astronomers, particularly astronomers used to working with different wavelengths, than what you do, radio astronomy. It kind of gets to, you'll pardon the pun, the image problem that radio astronomy has always had. I mean, if you get beyond Arecibo and the VLA, largely thanks to Jodie Foster, I think, we really just don't, the vast public, don't think much about these tools in radio astronomy, which are able, as you said, Al, to now... ALMA will resolve better than the Hubble Space Telescope. You are getting images from it.
That's right. I think most people, when they think of radio astronomy, think of perhaps in contact with the earphones on, right, listening to the hiss from outer space. I don't think we've ever heard a hiss from ALMA being processed through.
You'll let us know if you get a signal.
Absolutely.
We could turn it into a hiss, but it wouldn't be as meaningful as images are. So the real goal has always been to provide those stunning images. In the past, many radio images have sort of looked like blobs because we just haven't had as many antennas and as much sensitivity as ALMA has. So our goal is to make radio images as visually pleasing as those you get from the Space Telescope, in addition to making them as sharp.
You had a scientist downstairs who, as he was describing the spectacular results he's already getting from what you call cycle zero in this unfinished instrument, he was saying, but if only it was a magnitude, an order of magnitude bigger. Mm-hmm. Scientists are just never satisfied.
That's true. I was trying to see what our funding agency's fellow's face looked like when he asked for that.
So how far are we from seeing ALMA fully complete, all 66 of those telescopes working together through that amazing supercomputer?
Well, about a year.
We're very close now. That's right. Once the antennas started being delivered and the correlator was delivered, it all started to move very quickly. Mm-hmm. And right now, the antennas are going up as quickly as once a week up the mountain, and they're integrated into the array. A lot of tests are done, and then they're used for science. And so it's a very fast process with a lot of people working around the clock. They're operating 24 hours doing the engineering tests as well as making the science observations. So I think right now there are something like 46 antennas that could be used together in an observation, but we have both 12-meter and 7-meter antennas there. Now, in full ALMA, these will be used as two separate arrays. The 7-meter antennas will be used for observing things with a larger angular scale, larger structures in the sky, which are actually resolved out, meaning you don't see them at all using the 12-meter antennas because you simply have too much resolution, and so you don't see the large structures.
So these provide the context.
That's right, and so you'll be able to add the data from these two arrays together to see very fine detail on very large scales, which will be something that has not been done before. So that'll be a new thing for ALMA.
I want to thank you both very much for joining us for this conversation, particularly when there is so much other stuff going on here at AAS. And I hope that we can check back with you. I know that you've got a big day coming up, Al, the official inauguration of...
Yeah, in March. That's right. A giant ordeal.
Well, maybe we can check with you either before that or when you've relaxed a little bit afterward and talk a little bit more about how ALMA is coming together.
Sure, absolutely, Matt. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's something we're really looking forward to. Thanks for having us.
My complete conversation with scientists Al Wootton and Allison Peck about the tremendous new radio telescope called ALMA is available online at planetary.org/radio. Al is ALMA's North American project scientist and head of the North American ALMA Science Center at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Allison Peck led a team of ALMA commissioning scientists in Chile for 5 years. I'll be right back with Bruce Betts. Live on the Skype line, we've got Bruce Betts for this week's edition of What's Up. And I hope you can tell us about the night sky.
I can. It'll be very exciting.
Not as exciting as the answer to the trivia question, which brought out the rocker in our listeners.
Well, good. I look forward to finding out about that. In the meantime, I'll tell you about that night sky. We've got Jupiter, of course, still dominating the evening sky over in the east. If you pick this up right after it comes out, you may see the moon still in the either very close to it on Monday night or in its general neighborhood on Tuesday. We've got Mars low in the west. It's tricky to see, but low and reddish shortly after sunset. And what's interesting is Mercury will be coming to play with us in February, so it's coming up very low in the west. And Mars and Mercury will pass within 0.3 degrees of each other. In other words, really, really close on February 8th, although it will be tough to see because you'll have to have an open view to the western horizon in the early evening. But Mercury will then keep getting higher and Mars keep getting lower. In the pre-dawn sky, you can check out Saturn high overhead and Venus, also very low but super bright, for a little bit longer. You can see how much longer you can still see it over in the east. We move on to this week in space history. 1967 was the Apollo 1 fire that killed three astronauts. And in a much happier note, 2004, 9 years ago, Opportunity landed on Mars, still going strong. Off we go to random space. The X-15, which I know you enjoy.
Very much.
The space plane program hypersonic testing. I had 12 pilots over its history, the most famous being Neil Armstrong, for other reasons. In 2005, NASA awarded astronaut wings to three of the pilots, two of them posthumously, for going above 50 miles, which is one definition of space. The military pilots had already been given astronaut wings, but the civilians hadn't, primarily because NASA didn't award them at the time.
Well, good for them. Good on them. And I'm glad at least one of them was around to enjoy that honor. Well earned. That was such a terrific program.
All right, we move on to the trivia contest. And in a different take than usual, I asked you what song by what group starts with the lyrics, "We had a lot of luck on Venus, we always had a ball on Mars." Looking for the group and the song.
And we got both from many, many people, a near record setter in terms of responses to this question. I don't know whether it was the classic rock and roll that brought people out or the fact that our winner is going to get Bill Nye's voice on his answering machine. And it isn't a he because our winner is Chris Campbell, chosen by random.org. Everybody who entered had the right answer. The song is, I guess you know all too well, Bruce, was Space Truckin'?
Space Truckin' by Deep Purple.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, Space Truckin'.
We got all kinds of discography information from listeners. Some of it really quite fascinating. Claude Plimate pointed out it's on the album Machine Head, a classic of rock and roll. It was released in 72, although the song was written in 71, and apparently just about coincided with the arrival at Mars of Mariner 9 that went into orbit around the planet. I don't know if that's what inspired it or not. Claude also says that album featured the iconic song Smoke on the Water, dun, 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 that features the three first chords learned by just about every budding guitarist ever since. Let me tell you why I'm so happy that Chris Campbell of Atlanta, Georgia,